You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
It's interesting how it happened, how they did all gravitate. Because I highlight, in the book, I highlight four women. I could have highlighted 40 others. There was a point when I thought I should be calling this lesbians galore, you know. Because there were so many.
I'm dyking out, you're dyking out. Let's dyke out together. See what it's all about.
Dyking out!
Hi, and welcome to Dyking Out, a podcast that's the real reason why Ellen is ending her talk show. I'm Carolyn Bergier.
Mm-hmm. I'm Melody Kamali, and today we're dyking out with Diana Suhami about lesbian tastemakers.
Mm. Tasty.
Get ready to be influenced.
I like it. Remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you're looking for more content from us, we do put out an extra episode every week over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/dykingout. And on this week's episode, we talk about all sorts of things like what are Larrys and why are they mad at Olivia Wilde? What's this lesbian nun movie coming out?
What have we been up to this last
What's
week?
What's Melody's real heritage? Why was I in the ER? All that and more, if you can believe it, is waiting over on Patreon for you. So you can sign up for as little as $5 a month over there. That supports the pod, that keeps us going. But here we're going to talk about something a little different. Melody, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
Well, for those who aren't patrons yet, I'll say that I have been down south with Allie's family over the last week. So lots of opportunities to be gay with awkward silence and long looks, pregnant pauses, you name it. So out of nowhere, Allie's mom, we're all sitting around listening to country music. Every time I'm down in North Carolina, they make it their personal mission to convert me to a country music fan. It's just like this running bit at this point. And I don't actually hate country music that much, but like the more they try to push it on me, the more I retaliate. And it's just all fun, right? So we're sitting and we're listening to country music in the car. We're on our way back to the house one night, and Allie's mom, out of nowhere, just goes, "You know, Allison, why can't you just give Melody a pass just for one night?"
A pass?
Yeah. Now, I'm trying to figure out what this means, where this came from. You know, we're listening to a lot of, I guess, heteronormative country songs about, you know, settling down, starting a family. And in fact, I'm correct. Allie's mom wants us to do that. And in the moment, her best idea was, "Dear daughter, why can't you just give your girlfriend of 5 years a pass just to sleep with a man for one night?" I know you're a lesbian, dear daughter, but your bisexual girlfriend, on the other hand, why can't she have just one night with a man to get impregnated? That's what that meant.
Wow, that's a loaded pass.
So loaded. Allie's was like, Mom, what the fuck? We can do artificial insemination. We can adopt. There's so much we can do that doesn't involve the love of my life getting penetrated by a man that I don't. Like, we just had to sit down and explain to Allie's mom the exclusivity of our relationship.
And maybe Allie's mom watched season one of The L Word.
Yeah, right?
And saw them go to that art gallery and get that guy with the motorcycle.
The idea felt that old.
That's the best way to do it.
Yep. It was It was wild because we were just really in the trenches with her trying to explain our relationship. And we're like, God, well, then what have we been doing for the last 5 years? Like, she doesn't get it. And then, like, I mean, she did get it. Ultimately, at the end of the conversation, we could tell she was being a little tongue-in-cheek. And she's like, well, I'm just trying to speed up the damn process. She just wants grandchildren.
Oh, man.
I gotta say, that's the gayest thing I did this last week with my girlfriend, hand in hand, trying to explain our relationship for the umpteenth time to her mother.
While you're there for a funeral.
For a funeral.
You didn't expect this.
It's a roller coaster.
Mom was going to tell you to get some P in your V. Yeah.
So much happened this last week.
Wow.
And more in that in the Patreon episode if you're interested. But, you know, I have a pressing issue to get to. Carolyn, what is the gayest thing you did this last week?
The gayest thing I did, I know I teased it in our Patreon content preview that I was in the ER, and you'll have to listen on Patreon to learn why. But I did the dumb thing that I always tell myself not to do. And when my doctor there asked what I did for a living, I said I was a podcaster.
Oh.
Now.
Oh, honey.
I also freelance copyright. And I always tell myself, just say copywriter. There's never a follow-up question because most of the time people don't know what that is. And most of the time they think it's a legal thing that I'm
legally
like copywriting a book or something. And then it shuts it down right away. If I tell someone I'm a podcaster, they'll say, what's the name of the podcast? To then someone I met moments ago that's in charge of my health and well-being, I have to say, Dyking Out.
I know that game.
She was like, what kind of podcast? I was like, oh, it's just a comedy podcast. We do interviews and stuff. She goes away. I'm there for another 6 hours getting tests done and stuff. She comes back at the end to wrap up and she's like, by the way, what's the name of your podcast? I'm like, oh no, here we go. Because I had already gone through it with the nurse who overheard about the podcast. So when the doctor left, the nurse was asking me about it.
Oh, God.
And the doctor, she said, you know, I have this commute. I just moved now. I'm looking for podcasts to listen to. I don't know where to start. I would love to start with yours. And I'm like, well, it's called Dyking Out, and you really don't have to start with it.
Yeah, start with the Daily from
the New
York Times.
What are you looking for? What kind of podcast do you want? Do you want the news? Do you like murder? And she's like, I just like to get insights into lives that are different than mine. I'm like, I still think Dyking Out is too much. Like, this is just this. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't make assumptions. Maybe she was bicurious or something.
Carolyn, you better be careful. She's
gay.
Listening right now. She's listening right now. So,
oh my God, you're right.
You know,
I don't know why I assumed she was straight. Maybe she's not. I guess if I said Dyking Out and she wasn't straight, I'd get like a wink or something or have her say, oh, that sounds like something I would like, you know. But I just find myself regularly discouraging straight people I've just met from listening to the podcast. And I feel like I shouldn't do that, but I'm afraid that it'll be too much. It's like I want them to be an ally. I'm afraid if they listen, They'll get some ideas in their head. I don't know. They'll think they can use the word. Maybe they'll really think that we are the reason that Ellen ended her talk show. Like the nuance. You have to listen for a while to get the nuance
July,
of this.
They could think that.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it. I get the hesitation.
Right. So I think gatekeeping our culture is the gayest thing that I've done.
Oh, gatekeeping? So hot right now. in the sapphic community. Oh my God. Yeah. All count that. Say that. That's the gayest thing you did this week.
It is. Wow. Well, Melody, we did mention it. And I think before we get into this interview, it's worth mentioning it again.
I have to mention, guys, I found out about a death in the family, Allie's beloved Uncle Brian. We were both so close with him. I had just found out the night before this interview, we'd been up all night crying, making travel plans. I was completely drained, which is a shame because I was very much looking forward to this interview. The book is incredible. I've learned so much from this person. I just wasn't fully present for the interview. I tried. I think I got one or two questions out. Like, I was on a delay. It was like I was on a... this weird kind of broadcast delay where like everything was coming in 5 seconds too late and I would just give up. And I was just emotionally drained.
It was a really hard morning.
Yeah. And it was like, we don't record in the morning. Of course, the one podcast, because she's in the UK, we recorded at like 9 a.m.
Right.
And it was all just grounds for not the best performance on my part. And I do apologize for that. I really do.
No, you don't have to apologize. I just want everybody to know, though, that there was a reason for it, because you were really, we were both so excited to talk to this guest, and we didn't want to reschedule it because we had it scheduled for such a long time, and then this all kind of happened so fast. So it's a great interview. The guest is so charming. And who's that guest? Well, it is Diana Suhami, who is a celebrated author, all sorts of awards, known for her books about the lives of prominent lesbians in history. She is a Rainbow List national treasure. That sounds like something we should all aspire to. Her latest book, No Modernism Without Lesbians, is out now, and we can't wait to talk about it. So let's get into it. Diana, thank you so much for being here and diking out with us from across the pond, our favorite place.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I'm still not over the American Revolution. I think we should have just stayed a part of the UK, you know?
Yeah.
I just love it over
there. That's what was really keeping Carolyn up at night this last year, especially. Yeah. The American Revolution.
Well, there have been times where you could say it couldn't be worse.
Right.
So when you're with your last president and, or dare I say it, our current one, roll on the next revolution, really.
Right. Well, Diana, before we get into things, we want to ask you, what's the gayest thing you did this week?
Well, I think I am down in the Cornish countryside at the end of nowhere, the very tip of the country. I think the gayest, and I don't see people, I think the gayest thing I did this week was to video the resident woodpecker who's got two new, is teaching two woodpecker offspring to be self-respecting woodpeckers. And I did wonder, about pronouns for woodpeckers, whether it was a he or a she or a they. But when it came to a bug, I really didn't know whether it was a he or she or a they teaching these young
ones. Well, that consideration was the gayest part.
Yes. Contemplating the right, you don't want to misgender a bird. No.
I didn't want to offend.
Yeah. Nice. Especially when dealing with wood and peckers, you can't make assumptions.
True.
Tell me more about this woodpecker. Is it a big one?
Well, they have sort of, I'm getting quite good on bird life. They're quite carnivorous, and although they will eat nuts and things like that, they have red heads and breasts, and they're rather beautiful. And I did think it's interesting the way they teach their young to do what they do.
How do they teach them?
Well, they sort of hop along a bit and then turn around and the other little ones copy. I mean, how do you learn anything?
Right.
Just hop along.
We have a large woodpecker in our yard, one that has like the redhead. There are a couple breeds of woodpecker around me, but the big one, we're always impressed when we see it hopping about, but I haven't seen any offspring, but it's always very exciting. It's such a cool bird,
maybe it's a gay woodpecker and it doesn't do breeding.
Possibly. We have a very gay property.
Yes.
It used to be owned by lesbians years ago, we discovered. So we figure all the animals on the property must also be gay.
Well, it's quite an assumption. Yeah. I haven't gone too deeply into this. And I am going back to London next week. And actually, if there are too many conversations about woodpeckers, maybe it'll be a good thing if I actually see some people.
Yeah, balance.
Well, Diana, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got your start in becoming an author. You have quite the career in publishing.
Yes, well, the latest book I've written, which is called No Modernism Without Lesbians. I think it might be my 14th. I started writing books about lesbians about 35 years ago because I'm old. I'm 80 actually. I like saying that. I tell people at bus stops.
I love it.
I tell people at bus stops and boast about it, and yeah. I'm rather proud of having got thus far. But when I started writing, which was my way of coming out in many ways, because I wanted a mainstream publisher, I didn't use the word lesbian, and no mainstream publisher would have published a book with lesbian on the title. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have had to go to the feminist press or the smaller press. And so it's quite a sort of indication of how times have improved here or in some liberal democracies, that they actually want the word on the title, that they can see it as a selling point, as a proud thing, you know. And I felt, although I highlight four women in the book, and you wouldn't in today's terminology call them all lesbian, I was glad to have the word out there on the title, kind of proud and boasting and stripped of any kind of embarrassment or apology, you know.
Right.
And the fact that the publisher wanted it does to me indicate that things are moving, have moved along. And haven't they just moved along? And are moving almost so fast it's difficult to keep up. I mean, people ask me if I'm she or he or they, and to tell you the truth, half the time I just don't know.
Well, I love the cover of the book and the fact that it does say lesbians right on the cover, because it's great for signaling. You know, we get a lot of people that are like, how do I let people know that I'm gay? How can I be more visibly queer? And it's like, get this book, read it on the subway.
Take it to a cafe.
And then you'll find a girlfriend that way.
That's brilliant. The alternative to a T-shirt. And also, you don't have that way. You don't have to read it, do you?
Right.
Just hold it up. I've not thought of that. Or if you really want to annoy people and clear the train carriage just for yourself.
I do love it, though, that you use the word lesbian as kind of inclusive to whatever the identities of these, however they may have identified themselves, because I feel like over the past decade or so, there was this misconception that the word lesbian was like very exclusive and there was like a lot of gatekeeping around it. Whereas now I think we're pushing for it to be more inclusive and that it's still okay to call a bar a lesbian bar, even though we want people who identify as bisexual, pansexual, trans, whatever, to be able to go there and feel comfortable while still being able to call it a lesbian bar.
I agree, and that's the spirit that I use it in. I mean, as a dedication, I do dedicate it to LGBTQIA+, or whatever gets you,
and
the quilt bag. Yes.
Quilt bag. That was a new one for me.
Same.
I hadn't heard the term quilt bag before, and I kind of like it better.
Do you? Well, I don't mind using all 26 letters, you know.
Right.
But there is a danger to initialism, and you know that you you come in from on top and say you can't use words. And it is in the spirit of inclusivity that I use the word lesbian. I mean, the women that I write about, they, most of them didn't use the word for themselves. They would talk about their friend. But I do think it's important, whatever language you use or whatever initials you use, you try to get to the intention of the person who's speaking, you know. And if they falter and don't use your language, you don't have to necessarily come in on top and correct them if their intention was benign and inclusive.
Right.
And although, you know, language is shifting along, good, but I totally agree with you. I would like, I do, and would like to continue, partly because it's really rather difficult to get round all the terms. I mean, quiltbag, I forget what Q is queer, U is unisex, I is intersex, I forget, L is lesbian.
Queer, undecided, intersex, undecided. Lesbian, trans, bisexual, asexual, and then gay or genderqueer. I wrote it down because I really loved it, though, how, like, right up front, you did address it, and you addressed it in a way I think that aligns with a lot with how Melody and I are always talking about labels on this podcast. They're everything and they're nothing at the same time, and that people get so caught up in a label, and for someone who needs that label or wants that label, that's great if that helps you with figuring out who you are, but that at the end of the day we're individual people, and you had a statement about how to focus on a specific way of how they ID would have been doing a disservice to these women who are kind of larger than life.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true, and you know, in a way it's not what you are, it's how you are what you are, you know.
What I
really wanted to get to was their achievements, you know.
Yes.
That's where the celebration is, rather than... I mean, one of them, Briar, who was born Winifred Ellerman, and she was the daughter of the richest man in England, and she managed to get her inheritance and used it in a philanthropic way. But she would identify, she felt herself to be a boy born into a girl's body, and in today's terms, she would be transsexual. But you totally understood how she felt and who she was by the way she expressed it without using today's vernacular. And the important thing was what she did with her life, you know.
Yeah.
And with all the women, it's set in Paris between the wars, and they all gravitated to Paris. All of them made this huge and wonderful contribution and towards their own, not just their own freedoms, but towards the culture of the time, you know. So that was what I wanted to highlight, rather than the very fact of what their particular way of... Although, because I also wanted it to be character-driven and to show how they live their lives. But labels can be a useful shorthand, but they can also trip you up and corner you and claim you in a way you don't want to be claimed, don't you think?
Exactly. I love that. So going back, you said 35 years you've been writing about lesbians.
I have written about other things as well, but...
Yes. Like murder.
Like murder. Well, no, islands. Islands I've written about. I mean, there is a similarity, lesbians and islands, I think.
Yeah.
Lonely places.
And places I want to be. How did writing about this topic evolve with, like, your own understanding of your sexuality? Which came first?
Well, I think it was, for all those decades ago, it was for me really a sort of way of coming out to the world. Yes, it really was. And of breaking silence. I mean, I grew up, you know, there wasn't anything to read about lesbians when I was growing up. I was born in 1940. There was, you know, disapproval from my family, or they didn't want to hear. So for me, it was really... I began this book because the first book, it was called Gluck. It was about a society painter called Hannah Gluckstein, who dressed in very androgynous clothes and was very out and fell passionately in love with another woman. And I saw a painting by her. She called it the You We picture, and it was of her and her lover's profiles merged, and they looked defiant. And it's an iconic lesbian picture. Anyone would look at anyone who was lesbian would look at it and know what was going on. They stare defiantly into the distance, you know.
Yeah.
In fact, it was used on an exhibition just recently, in an exhibition of queer art at the Tate Gallery here in London. Then, after I'd seen that exhibition, I got a letter from a publisher saying that they liked my bits of journalism and my book reviews. Did I have a book I wanted to write? So I thought of writing this book on Gluck. And that was my way of getting into... I was working at the BBC at the time. I handed in my notice because I got a commission to write. And then one thing led to another, and I've kept going with other books since that bit of serendipity and that stroke of good fortune, and which also, for me, was a way of, if you like, saying what I couldn't say because I didn't know my own way of expressing myself. So, if you like, I did it through other people, through my writing, well, about biographies of lesbians, yes.
I love that. You mentioned that, you know, there really wasn't much written or anything that you could find that was written about lesbians. And I feel like that was true for the most part until recently, that it's always been this niche category. Like, you really have to hunt to find writings about lesbians. And then now all of a sudden it feels like there's this flurry of interest, especially in the media and like TV and film, in revisiting the lives of these historical figures and artists and writers and telling their story where they're finally not erasing their sexuality. So you have Emily Dickinson, Colette, Anne Lister in Gentleman Jack, Queen Anne in The Favorite. What are your thoughts on all of this? Does it feel like all of a sudden, or?
Yes, I think people are coming out of the kindergarten. I mean, the book, in this book that I've just written, where it's set in Paris between the wars. And what happened was that because there was censorship in the States and in Britain, you know, that book, which was one of the only ones that was around when I was growing up, when it didn't come away from censorship until 1949, was The Well of Loneliness, a terrible, terrible, depressing story. But it was censored as obscene and burned in the King's Furnace in this country and banned in the States. D.H. Lawrence was banned, you know, Ulysses, James Joyce's Ulysses, there was censorship. And so you couldn't write about it, you couldn't write poetry, you couldn't mention the word in the early decades of the 20th century and be published. So what women did, what lesbians, gay women did, they got out. They got out and they went to Paris. You know, Gertrude Stein, who's one of the characters I write about, she said it wasn't just what Paris gave you, it was all it didn't take away. And you could be who you were in Paris. And they were. You know, they met their partners, they contributed. I mean, Sylvia Beach is one of the characters that I write about in this latest book. She started the bookshop, Shakespeare and Company, an English language bookshop, where writers and artists gravitated towards us. And she single-handedly published Ulysses, which was banned as obscene and wouldn't have seen the light of day if it hadn't been for her. And that's considered a seminal book, seminal modernist novel, the breakaway from 19th century traditions. And they were just totally themselves because they freed themselves from patriarchy. They got out and they formed their own community. And it was very supportive. It was very nice because rents were cheap and food was good. And it was an extraordinary community. And they harked back to Sappho and the her community of women in ancient Greece. Sappho figured large in their thinking, and they really did, you know, break from patriarchy. And so in many, it resonates totally now where there is a sort of women don't have to hide their gender or their sexuality or their sexual orientation. And they're not saying it in an apologetic way, will you accept me, please? They're saying, look, look how good I am, you know, look at what I achieve. And so I call my book No Modernism Without Lesbians, because it's just not been, it's just not said enough just how influential they are to this whole way of breaking from old ways of seeing and being, the old patriarchal ways, into freedoms of expression, you know. And it the Second World War came down like a shutter and stopped it all. But I think that now there's the same feeling, you know, it's not asking for acceptance, it's saying, look what I can offer, look what I'm doing, look how talented I am, look, do you know? And there's so much evidence of it now, don't you think?
Yeah, I think for so long, nobody wanted us to connect the dots. It was like they were afraid that if we connected the dots between freedom from the patriarchy and this great creativity and progress and cultural movements, that we would descend into a pit of hell or something like that. So we talk about these stories of these women individually, or at least, you know, my exposure to it. So what I love about your book is it ties it all together and kind of shows how their sexuality factored into their fate and their decisions. Yes. You know, they wouldn't have gone to Paris had they been able to write without being censored in the U.S., perhaps, you know.
Well, I think this is true. And I did realize this from having written individual biographies. And I didn't want to write just sort of one thing after another biographies. In each one, I wanted, if you'd like, a different conceptual underpinning. So I wrote about Gertrude Stein and Alice B. Toklas, and the conceptual underpinning was that, you know, here was a truly happy marriage when so many, they sort of followed the rules of the perfect heterosexual marriage, which so many heterosexual people failed to achieve. And they succeeded, so it was the irony that they succeeded in that. With another book, Mrs. Keppel and Her Daughter, I wanted to write about hypocrisy, because Mrs. Keppel was the lover of the King of England, King Edward VII. Her daughter, Violet Trefusis, fell in love with Vita Sackville West, was pilloried and forced into a loveless marriage and banished to Paris. The Charles of Radcliffe Hall, I wanted to write about how her life was a trial, as well as her book was censored when it was so anodyne. So, but they were all individual stories, even though I didn't want them, I wanted them to have to exist in their own right as books. But with this, it was this fact of the work of a community, and the fact that they had to get away, and that how, if you are gay, lesbian, you can't be of the patriarchy. You can't, unless you're going to live a lie. And so in order to be authentic, of course they had to break away, and of course they had to start anew. So when you talk about modernism, which is the break from the past, the shock of the new, you have to accept that gender reorientation in societal terms is part of a modernist thing. Do you know? Because how can you be part of the old school? You can't. You can't. So that was, for me, a kind of, it's a sort of coming together of other stories, you know, because people I'd written about before figure again, but within the context of community, of movement, of contribution, of the whole being more than the parts, you know.
One of the things I loved reading about in the book was the salons that were held. Can you talk a little bit more about this scene? Because it's so interesting, and it makes you wish that you could have been there at that time, right?
I think you're right. It would have been a wonderful time to have been in Paris. But there were Gertrude Stein, she held these Saturday afternoon salons, because Gertrude Stein, when she was really young, in her 20s, she and her and Picasso and Cézanne and Matisse were unknown. They were just, you know, they were scarcely more than art students. And she bought their works for very little money because she liked them. And took them home and hung them on the walls of their Paris apartment. And before long, of course, she had a collection of paintings that were beyond price and that she couldn't insure. They didn't even bother to frame them, you know. They'd go home with two Cezannes and a Matisse and a Picasso, you know.
Right. Very casual, yeah.
Casual. They'd have honey cakes and tea and then take them all home. And people were so interested in these weird paintings and wanted to come and see them. So they started to sort of organise it and contain it. They started having these Saturday afternoon salons where people came to look at these paintings. They were called, well, the Fauve, the Wild Beasts. And, of course, people were shocked because it was so different from 19th century painting, which is reproduction of what you actually see. And then Natalie Barney, she had her son, as they were called, the Hazardous Fridays. She held them on Friday afternoons. And when the word got round that that's where you met lesbians, as well as you'd go there and read your poems and talk about your artistic endeavours and pick up someone and have... had strawberry tarts and cucumber sandwiches, and so they became famous. Everybody who was anybody went to Natalie Barney's Friday salons. So it was, I mean, this thing of how do you meet people of a like mind, of like feelings? What do you do about it? You know, how do you not be the only one? This was how it resolved. And Paris did become like a magnet. I mean, you heard of it and you heard what was going on and you wanted to join it. It's interesting how it happened, how they did all gravitate. Because I highlight in the book four women. I could have highlighted 40 others. There was a point when I thought I should be calling this lesbians galore, you know. Because there were so many.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow... grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
You hear about Hemingway and Ezra Pound, and thank you for talking about the actual lesbians at these Paris salons. Every time I was exposed to them in literature classes, that we were always just talking about the men there. And Gertrude Stein hosted, you know, like it was just an afterthought, at least in a lot of the lit classes I took.
Well, she made their fortunes. I mean, Hemingway and Scott Fitzgerald, you know, they showed her their manuscripts. She told them how to do it better, you know. I mean, it was, and then they wrote memoirs where they, and then they fell out with each other because everybody falls out with everybody, you know, and chastise each other in print. But it is absolutely true. I mean, you know, Joyce, James Joyce's Ulysses It would not have seen the light of day without Sylvia Beach publishing it. And he treated her very badly, Joyce. And when he did get a mainstream publisher, he took the money and didn't give her any. I mean, there were lesbians who were at the front. I mean, Brower, Winifred Elliman, she started, who was born Winifred Elliman, called herself Brower. She started up Contact Editions with the money that she'd inherited, which published for the first time Hemingway and Ezra Pound and Gertrude Stein, and they wouldn't have managed it without this input from lesbians who were themselves creating. I mean, Brower's partner, H.D. Hilda Doolittle, who had an affair with Ezra Pound and was significantly a better poet. Why don't people know more about her? You know, it's gone on for too long and it needs correcting.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think the moral from this is don't do favors for men, ever.
No. I think so. I mean, well, no, I do start with a quote from Virginia Woolf, where she's inviting Vita Sackville-West to go for a walk with her by the river, and she says, "Throw over your man and we'll walk together
right.
in the moonlight by the river."
I love that.
And I do think it's not a bad thing, just throw over your man, you know, when it comes to the foreground of achievement and input and creativity, it is time to throw over the men, I think, and let's see what the women have done, the women especially lesbian women have done. And they're not because I'm saying there's a sort of creative hierarchy, but because they had to be steps ahead because they couldn't conform.
I agree with that. Throw over the men. And well, part of it, and something I've noticed a little bit in my own life, is that the relationships that men have with lesbians are different than the relationships that they have with women who they might sleep with. And that the relationship sometimes with lesbians is that sometimes they still expect the kind of emotional labor and support that they've grown up thinking that women naturally owe them, or that we're this like endless resource for.
Well, there needs to be such re-education, doesn't there? I mean, the idea of sex as possession, which has blighted women's careers and identity, which has come from sex, that you are possessed, not your body, your sexuality, your name, your money,
right.
your everything is that idea, and getting rid of that idea. It's men have to relearn it as well, of course, and all these efforts towards it, like not taking the name of the man, how do you name yourself, do you know? Why is your surname your father's name, you know? It's this making invisible, which is the ultimate possession, isn't it? That you, not just possession, but that you stamp on identity in order to make women part, just an accessory, if you like. And it's been, well, I don't even need to say it, it's just the ways of changing it and the speed with which it, I mean, it's for me, it's very gratifying that it's an honourable thing to be lesbian, you know, that I don't have to say, I'm afraid I'm a lesbian, you know, that I don't have to, well, my parents are dead, but, you know, it's their problem if they can't hack it, you know. I don't have to say it to anyone. All these coming out stories, which are sort of rocking backwards and forwards with pain, you know, mm-hmm. saying things that people don't want to hear, all that, I just feel totally impatient with it now. Just it must be of the past. It must be this celebration, or celebration's a funny word, this realization of what's been achieved has to be at the foreground, and what can still be achieved. No apologies, no asking for acceptance. Here I come, you know. and it's at the root of all the tolerances, isn't it? Colour as well.
Right.
You know, what about the kindergarten? I mean, just finish with it. It goes on and on. It's interesting how when fascism is in the air, what do they always pick on? They pick on skin colour, they pick on gender orientation, nationality, mm-hmm. you know, all these sort of kindergarten things.
One of the things I loved in the book was reading about the relationships between the women and their partners and just how supportive they are, that they support each other's ambitions. Like, it's Sylvia, she got the help and the support and the encouragement to open a bookshop.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. She met. It's a rather nice story. She was in Paris and studying French literature. There was a journal she wanted, and she went to the bookshop of Adrienne Monnier, who had a bookshop in the 6th arrondissement. And she looked through the window and saw her, and then a gust of wind blew Sylvia's hat down the road, and Adrienne came out and rescued the hat, and then they went in and love began. Do you know? It was, and you know those sort of rather wonderful moments of beginnings, first encounters. And you could feel it, and it's a timeless thing. You could just see them both. You could see, and then it was Adrienne who helped Sylvia start her bookshop. I mean, Breyer, who had read the poetry of H.D. and then went and she wrote a letter to her, and a fan letter, and called on her in the Silly Arse, down near where I am at the moment. And the door opened and she sort of knew. Do you know, there are these wonderful, timeless... You have to pinch yourself to realise that this is 1918 or 1920. Oh, it's 100 years ago and more, because it's how it works, you know, that sort of wonderful feeling. So there's that's universal and beyond time, you know. So there's this sense that although things must change and do change, I think it's almost like a pendulum swings, you know. As I said, the Second World War came down like a shutter and ended this whole era. But now you feel the pendulum swings back again. But within that swing, the universal things continue. Women fall in love with each other. Men fall in love with each other. Men and women fall in love with each other. It goes on, you know.
And I know we talked about Paris already, but can we go back to Paris? Because we recently did an episode of this podcast where we did focus on kind of the homophobia and racism of Paris. I think we've said enough, and we haven't celebrated the sapphic history of Paris enough on the record, right, Carolyn?
Yeah.
Well, what was interesting, I think, about this that. I think, again, to go back to that quote of Gertrude Stein, it wasn't just what Paris gave you, it was all it didn't take away. I mean, the indigenous French liked art and they existed, the women who went there existed as a community within a community. And, I mean, I'm sure there's bigotry in whatever society you go into. There wasn't censorship. They couldn't censor what they were writing. But it was a community within another that was within another country. You know? English was the language that was being used, although Nathalie Barney wrote in French and Sylvia Beaches spoke fluent French. And it's interesting how places take on an identity at certain times and became the gravitational thing towards them, makes them very attractive, like Berlin was. You know, and, right. And then it wasn't, you know, because of war, because of politics as well, you know. I mean, we now see sort of wonderful, wonderful cultured places like Tehran or like Athens that then clamp down because of political repression. So, again, the pendulum swings, I think.
Reading about all of the different locations in Paris, it made me want to take a lesbian historical walking tour of sorts. Have you done that? Have you gone and visited
these
spots in whatever form they are today?
I have, with the various books that I've been writing. I've gone to see where Gertrude Stein lived, where Shakespeare and Company still exists. Although it's become a rather... It's a much more tourist thing now than when Sylvia Beach was running it. But, you know, to see where they were, to see where Nathalie Barney was. Yes, I have just done that, walked around and looked. And Paris is architecturally so beautiful that you can still see how it was. It's a good thing to do, you know. And you can almost... There still are the cafes and the sense... Because, you know, and the bars and the sense of what it was like. You can still recreate it. It's a nice thing to do, to drop down where they lived, where they met, and then to walk the streets of Paris recreating it,
Yeah.
It's also interesting to read about this and going back to the salons, too. In a year that we've been shut down and not gathering with people, and it makes me wonder, what have we lost by not having these meetups of the mind in person? Because it's so, you can't recreate it on Zoom.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's an interesting thing. How would any of those characters... I can't see Gertrude Stein zooming. I think she would have been
you never know, though.
She would have been most impatient with it. It would have had to be Alice B. Toklas who did all the sort of, you know, downloading and plugging in. And she would have just sat there and had it all fixed for her. I can't see Natalie Barney. I mean, I included Natalie Barney because she said that her life was a work of art, you know. Also, she was so out, you know. She gave courage to others.
Talk about her love life a little bit.
Well, you know, she said, people call it unnatural. All I can say is it's always come naturally to me. You know, she had a way of saying things that just diffused any kind of apology or hesitation. Yes, she held her salons, and she said that her life was a work of art and that love was the chief endeavour of her life. And boy, did she go through them. Yeah, I mean, it was... The danger of, I felt, writing about it was if you have too many names, it becomes very confusing, you know. She said she once...
Right.
She once had 18 assignations in one night, you know. Yeah. Do you believe that? I don't. But she certainly... She went through... She divided her relationships into relationships, liaisons and affairs, you know. And the affairs, Alice B. Toklas rather caustically said she picked up her affairs in the toilets of Paris department stores. Do you know whether she did? I don't know where she did, but she seldom was in a bed alone, Natalie. She had a huge appetite.
Right.
Huge sexual appetite.
18 in one night, I think most of us would think like 18 in a lifetime would be a...
it might be...
Something to brag about.
Might be 15, or might be 12 too many. It's just so exhausting. But she...
Right.
She was tough. I mean, I couldn't approve of Natalie because... Although she was sort of loyal to her main relationship, there was always someone who was sort of biting their pillow in the small hours of the night in grief that they'd been loved and left, you know. So she did cause a lot of pain to quite vulnerable young women, I think.
So she was...
Shane?
The Shane, yeah.
Yes.
The Shane of her time.
Well, you know, Dolly Wilde was one of them who really, you know, was troubled. And that's Oscar Wilde's niece. Oscar Wilde floats through in their thinking and their respect. They all respected him. And Dolly Wilde, who looked like Oscar Wilde, she fell in love with Natalie Barney. And they had an affair, but it was... For Dolly Wilde, it was all important, and for Natalie, it wasn't. When you're reading about it, it can begin to feel a bit ruthless when it's encapsulated.
Right. An immense amount of research went into this book, and I want to know, what were some of your favorite discoveries along the way? What were the anecdotes you came across that really delighted you?
I don't know if I can pull those up without thinking about it. I think that what really did delight me was that I realised when I was writing it, you know, you think you've got a book that you're going to write and it's going in a certain direction, and then the book takes over, if you like, you know, and almost goes its own way. But I realized that there was more to it than I knew would be there. Do you know that I know this isn't directly answering your question. It's because I'm a little bit flummoxed about how to answer it directly. What really did impress me was that this added up to more than I knew that I had. This elision of these women, putting them side by side, just that it showed up how broad the term lesbian can be, or how broad the idea is of same-sex love, you know, how broad it is, and that you see it in a sort of very real sense. That was what I felt. How can I be more direct? What did I like? I think I like the sayings of Gertrude Stein when she says, it's hard work being a genius. You have to sit around so much doing nothing, you know. And then I like the way she said, I like the thing she'd say, 20th century literature is Gertrude Stein, you know. It's her ridiculous, emphatic boasting that almost seemed humble because it was so awful. Or she'd say, think of the Bible, think of Shakespeare, and think of me, you know.
I love that.
It's quite good fun.
Is she your favourite lesbian?
Gertrude. Is she my favourite? I mean, they look kind of strange. They're wonderfully photogenic, even while looking really quite sort of... I had a horror when young of looking sort of... of having to look a certain way if I was lesbian, you know. That there would be a look that that I didn't want, or I don't feel it now, but you know, this sort of horror when you're trying to find your own identity. They didn't mind what they looked like. They really didn't. Was Gertrude my favourite lesbian? I like the way she wrote completely unreadable, incomprehensible prose, which flummoxed everybody, but was utterly down to earth in her daily life, you know, full of sort of common sense and wisdom. Yet she wrote this seemed to be nonsense, you know. But what she was doing was challenging what words meant.
I think a lot about these women and how they lived their lives, and they, as you mentioned, they may not have referred to themselves as lesbians or their partners. They would call their friends, but it's kind of like this open secret, and it feels like it's still like that today when it comes to people who are famous, that they live a life with a woman. Like, anybody who knows them knows that they're gay. But in the public eye, it's like, unless you come out and announce it on the cover of a magazine or something, you're still deemed closeted. What did the closet look like back then?
Well, dangerous, of course, because of censorship, you know. I mean, if what you write is not going to be published because... Radcliffe Hall's courage, if you like, when she wrote this book, The Well of Loneliness, was that she did change pronouns. I mean, the only sexy thing that happens is she says she kissed her on the lip. She kissed her full on the lips. Well, you know, she'd actually said it, whereas others would be very circumlocutory and write about what they felt well, Virginia Woolf did it in a very literary way. Orlando, which was about Vita Sackville-West, was published in 1928, which was Virginia Woolf writing about her love affair with Vita Sackville-West. That passed the censors because it was so literary. Radcliffe Hall's book, also published in 1928, was censored just because she did use pronouns in a very specific way. So I think people should be allowed to express themselves in whatever way they want, you know. I don't think it's up to other people to come in from on top and say, this is how you must behave, this is what you must do, these are the words you must use, this is how you must express yourself. Because it's a personal way of... I do think that pretending to be something other than you are is always dangerous and unfortunate. But to express yourself using your own voice, that's important, isn't it?
Is a little bit, yeah.
Not to, you know... I do hate it, the coming in, which I think a lot of the initialism and labelling can do, can't it? Oh, you can't say that. I mean, right. I get ticked off by people who say this, that you shouldn't be using that word. I mean, if people want to call themselves they, that's fine. It takes time to... I mean, for me, of a different generation, it takes time for me, just as I'm not... I haven't got a gene for Zooming and using all the technological stuff. I haven't got a gene for quilt bagging very readily, you know. I have to be helped into the quilt bag.
It seems like you're doing pretty well with it, and honestly, it moves fast for all of us, I think, regardless of... Does I think it? Anybody who's over the age of, 28 at this point is trying to keep up.
It's a relief to hear you say it, because it makes you nervous and you half expect to be pounced on with anything you say, you know.
Right,
and,
right.
And if we do sort of stutter and stumble our way towards self-expression, well... You know, that's not a crime, is it? I know, it is difficult. I mean, the one that I really, puzzle over is the intolerance towards trans people. You can find lesbians who are very intolerant of trans people, you know.
Mm-hmm, right.
And it's that seems to me horribly intolerant, you know, because... I've just read the memoir of Jan Morris, you know, and it's exactly the same. Breyer says exactly the same thing. This sense that they, for a trans person, that they have been born into the wrong body, is so intense, and it can happen so early, and is so abiding and unalterable, and not to be, and so. If you're convinced you are a woman, it takes empathy to go into that feeling. What must it be like? Because it's not at all like being lesbian, say. I mean, you
right.
That's that your desire is towards women, and your whole feelings are towards women. But to be, feel that you are in that to not empathize with that. I hate one identifying as one thing and then picking on another way
right.
of being and being intolerant of it, you know.
Right. It's like they can't see that it's the same arguments that were at one point used against
that's right.
them.
That's right. That's
that,
right.
That
you're
they're
not
using
allowed.
Toward
that's right. that's
other
right.
people.
That's
yeah.
Right. That's right. It's a disappointment, I think. Because
right.
at the heart of all these things is to love your crooked neighbour with your crooked heart, as some poet said, you know. Do you know?
It's being your authentic self and being allowed to live your life as who you are.
Yes.
And that who you are, to some extent, isn't a choice. It's not like you woke up one day and decided to be trans or a lesbian or whatever.
And it's benign. You know, it's not that you want to go out with a meat cleaver and kill everybody who isn't the same as you. But to have gone through a process of struggling to find identity and then to come down hard on someone else who's going through a struggle to find identity but in a different manner just seems to me, you know, that isn't acceptable, no.
Going back to the book and the research that went into it, how do you go about undertaking that? Where do you start? Where do you end? When do you know enough is enough?
Mm. Yeah, those are such interesting questions, I think. I have this sort of adage, if in doubt, out. I think if things are dull, leave them out. And if they're boring, leave them out. Because you have to be conscious. You know, there's some researchers, they find something they don't want to, they're like hoarders, they don't leave anything out. But I think if you're not keeping to a theme, then leave it out, because think of your poor reader. For me, a lot of the work, I wonder, there's an evolution, a pragmatic evolution as well. I had wanted to write a biography of Breyer, who is one of the characters that I highlight in this. It's very hard to, and this is an obstacle that really is hard to overcome, relating up to things we've said earlier about all the women who aren't, the lesbian women, gender, queer women who aren't known. Publishers don't want to give advances or commission books about people they don't know. You know, I mean, you can get any old, and loads of books about, I don't know, Winston Churchill or... But if you haven't, so when I said I'd like to do a biography of Breyer, people said who? They hadn't heard of her. They wouldn't be able to sell the copies. So that's a pragmatic reason for including her in a different context. I was also helped because I'd written about some of them before, so I knew a lot about them, all these decades of research. I think it's always a good idea to, I use this word, a conceptual underpinning, to have a concept of what you want your book to be about, rather than one damn thing after another. I like to start with a concept and then to fit things into that, and if they don't fit in, to save them for another day.
I would describe these women as being the tastemakers of a movement. Do you think that lesbians today are still at the forefront of being tastemakers?
I do, actually. I do. I mean, I can't give you an inventory or a summary or a list of them all. But you look at filmmakers, at all the good work that's being done. You know, the two are inseparable because rather than concentrating on wanting social acceptance and social validation, I do think it's quite good to think, look, I'm 12 paces in front. I'm not taking any of that stuff that. All the myths of societal convention. I've left those. So that puts you into a clear field. And then, I'm not saying that there's some inborn talent in lesbians, but you are, if you have...
I'm saying that.
Well, if you have got a talent, then you're in a clearer field, I think.
Yeah, right.
Go forward with it. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, I think that sums it up. Yeah, for sure. I mean, so much of it, I think, is just the disregard for the patriarchy and not feeling confined by that and not doing things for the purpose of pleasing men, I think, puts you on a different level.
I mean, but what I like about the women in this, rather than staying home and throwing stones through the windows of these ludicrous men who are not publishers saying that what they're writing is obscene, they get the hell out. And I do think getting out is really quite a good thing if you can't function within the ethos that you'll find yourself in. You know, get out if you can. I mean, and then there's, of course, a lot of people, a lot of women, men who are trapped. But if you can get away from the downward pull of negativity, then it's a good thing to do.
Reading your book, there were so many literary references and ones that, I mean, I would not describe myself as being well-read, but it made me want to read some of the pieces mentioned. So for me and for our other listeners, after reading your book, of course, what are some of your recommendations of literature that we really, if you identify as queer, should really dive into? I have to read The Well of Loneliness?
Well, skim through it. But, yes, look at it, because it, I mean, no, don't, not unless you want to depress yourself. I think Juna Barnes is really, she read, what's another interesting thing that they all do is to incorporate each other in fiction. So Juna Barnes wrote this book, Nightwood, which was about her love affair with Thelma Wood, and it was really rather difficult and fraught. So that's worth reading. She wrote a book called The Lady's Almanac, which is about Natalie Barney and quite a spoof on her. So that's one that's quite interesting. Violet Trefusis wrote about her love affair with Vita Sackville-West, and they wrote a book about their love affair called Challenge. There's loads, you know, if you want to get into how they were all in code writing about each other, there's plenty to go for, if that's your sort of thing. But hey, begin with mine.
I want it to be my
thing. Begin with my book, of
yes.
course.
Yes, for sure. It was so fascinating to read, and, you know, I thought that coming out as a young age, that it made me like this expert lesbian. And the older I get, the more I realize I have no idea about the long line of women before me that made it so I could come out when I was 17 and even realize, or so that I could make a podcast called Dyking Out. So I have my homework set out for me, but it was so great. I mean, especially both Melody and I love Paris. Half my family lives in France, so that even made it more of a joy to to go through and learn about these women in this special place.
Well, you see, you're carrying on the good work, aren't you?
Diana, where can people get your book? And are you on social media? Do you want people to follow you?
Well, I've
tell us what you want. We'll do it.
I've got a Twitter thingy, but I'm not very good at it. I'm not very good at putting things on it. You know,
same here.
I think you should do photos of what you have for breakfast, shouldn't you? And I should put the wood. I'll put the woodpecker on it if.
Yes, we want to see this woodpecker.
All right. Yes, and I have got a Facebook account, but the last entry might have been some time ago. A neglected account.
No modernism without lesbians. It's out now.
Yes, in the States. Okay. Yes, it was out last year in the UK.
So it's out now in the States. Support your local bookshop if you can, or get it wherever you can and dive into it. You'll enjoy it. Diana, anything else you want to leave our listeners with?
No, just thank you for talking to me across the pond, you know. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us.
Too bad Diana couldn't stick around to give advice, because I feel like she knows it all.
A well of knowledge. A wealth of knowledge. She is a well full of wealth of knowledge. How about that?
A Wawa of knowledge.
She is like a full Wawa store of knowledge. She's got so much. She's got it in back stock.
But instead, you have to settle for us.
So here we go. We'll take a stab at it. Okay, guys, we've got a listener question this week, as we tend to. Let's get into it. My ex and I see each other pretty much every day, and I'm still in love with her. We cut things off because she needed time to figure out how to love herself before she can show me love. I respect that, but it's just so hard to see her all the time and not be with her. But it's also so hard to not see her. What do I do?
You live in a self-made prison of emotional torture. That's what it sounds like you're doing. What are you doing?
The gayest thing you've said all week.
What do you do? Stop seeing her.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm sure you don't need to socialize so frequently around her.
Yeah.
Let it breathe. Give it some space.
This is a recipe for disaster. So many of us have been through it.
Yeah.
It almost never turns out well.
No.
And if you get back together, it will, just the baggage is accumulating, and that baggage is full of resentment. And to unpack it all is going to be a lot of work. So it's better to completely separate, and then maybe one day, if it's meant to be, you'll reunite. And I tell everybody that, and I feel like nobody wants to listen, and nobody wants to do that.
It's not that no one wants to listen. No one wants to hear that. It's really tough. Let her maybe have these feelings for you. Like, remove yourself.
Yeah.
Right? My ex and I see each other pretty much every day. Why? Why you do that?
It doesn't have to be that way. And saying it's hard not to see her, yeah, duh. Like, breakups are hard. I should be nicer.
No, we're being such assholes.
I mean, listen, we've had a really tough week, and we're going to give it to you straight. I've been watching a lot of Housewives.
Okay, give us the old Bethany Frankel.
I'm feeling inspired to tell it to you how it is. It's hard. It's supposed to be hard. And when you do the easy things, that makes it harder for you in the long run. It makes everything worse. Stop seeing her. Also, a red flag, we cut things off because she needed time to figure out how to love herself before she can show me love. Do you really believe that it was a we decision?
Right, yeah.
This person,
I've been there too. I get
run away. Run away. Yes. Run away and don't look back. And if she races out in front of you one day, then you can look forward at her, but run and don't look back.
Right. Let her see if she is pining after you after this. I mean, you guys haven't even separated yet fully.
Right. And honestly, if you really care about her figuring out how to love herself, then stop being around her. If you're breaking up so that she can do this by you being around, you are preventing the work from happening.
Impeding the goal.
Yeah. So it's completely pointless. All you are doing is making yourself and each other feel more pain than is necessary. So rip off the Band-Aid.
Yeah, you guys.
I feel like I've been so stern with the past few questions. I'm like, look, this is how it is. And I think it is a housewife. So that means it's Melody's fault. Listeners, if you think I've been a real bitch.
It's my fault. Well, then it's I'm Melody's definitely fault. Not going to help by chiming in with my like depressing monotone. I'm so sorry I don't have the inflection to finesse, but like I agree with everything Carolyn said. And you really need to put that actual distance and space between you because it doesn't seem like you've done the full breakup yet. Is she really your ex? Like you really need to not see each other or speak to each other. I'm a big advocate of that.
Right.
I love space.
Yes.
I'm not seeing it here. There's so many other people out there, too. I know how we get. I know
my
how
my first,
these
like, really toxic.
So your first toxic. No, I want to hear about this.
In my first, like, toxic relationship that I had that spanned years, the reason why it was a toxic relationship was that whenever we broke up, we still talked to each other all the time and nothing healed. And it confused everything. And then it made us feel like we should get back together when we should not have gotten back together. And it was just a cycle of toxic breaking up and getting back together until I hated her. I felt like I hated her and I lost any nice feeling toward her and I didn't care about her anymore. And after that, I was like, I will never let it get to that point again.
You're probably not going to love her journey, which would translate to you not loving her as much. Like, it's probably better for you to remember things as they were and just kind of move on and let her go through the motions. It's not going to be lovable on your end, watching from afar. So just create that respectful space, right?
Yes. Yep. Marie Kondo it. Thank the relationship for the joy that it sparked and then give it away.
Guess what?
Drop it off.
So many things can spark joy. Give it a little charge. Some have battery requirements, but you can also go to Early to Bed, a Chicago-based store that has primo glass dildos and I'm sure vibrators. And what was the term you had just used, Carolyn, that I prompted this whole tangent that I'm
Sparking joy.
Yes. And there you will find other things to spark your joy while you move on emotionally.
Yes. And that's okay to see those things every day.
Yeah, multiple times a day.
Are you a messy U-hauler? Do you have a question for us? Send it to dykingout@gmail.com. Do you want me to tell it to you how it is? If you want me to give you BS fluff that makes you feel good, just add that as a note to the question and I won't be so harsh.
Just become one of my close friends. That's how I'll tell it to you. But, you know, podcast listeners, I'll tell it to you straight and real.
Let me know you're a tender queer before I make you cry. Sometimes I picture the listener getting really upset, like they weren't ready for it.
Oh, no. I mean, this is such a
This happened. This is a universal question.
Yeah.
Universal. We've all been there. We relate.
And we know what to do. And let's forge ahead on your own with some safe distance and space.
A great thing that you can do to forge ahead is follow us at Dyking Out on social media.
Definitely.
We are still on the Stereo app, but doing it a little bit less as our lives have experienced some upheaval recently. Mm-hmm. You can follow me at TGI Carolyn and see what my hair is up to.
You can follow me at Melody Kamali and see what my hair is up to. I think it's due time I post this cut.
Yes.
Let's do it.
We should post it on the same day.
Okay. let's do it.
Thank you so much for diking out with us this week, and
we'll see you next Tuesday.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.